Hey, everybody. It's time for Beyond the Matrix. Time flies when you're having fun. Oh, boy, I'm sorry I wasn't with you last week. I was down with a cold, believe it or not, and taking care of myself, bundling up with tea and rest and listening to my body, which is saying, will you slow down? So I have done that, and I'm back on target. Just a few announcements before I bring on my exciting guests, and those are, I hope you're paying attention to the vaccination issue. I'm starting to bring this information out publicly. You know how I feel about sticking needles in arms and what this might mean to you. So get informed. There's plenty of information out there. Don't let yourself be, hypnotized by the spinners of strange viewpoints on your health and your body. All right, that's the first. The second is, wow, my new book, Where Pharaohs Dwell, is in pre-sale, and it's selling like crazy, and the publisher thinks it's going to sell out really quickly. So if you haven't pre-ordered it yet, do get it. It's Where Pharaohs Dwell. You can get it on pre-order it on Amazon.com, and I'd love you to do that so you can get it before Christmas when it might already be out of stock. All right, that's my spiel for the moment. Today I have with me Dr. Matthew James, who I've asked permission to call Matthew to undo any formality between us. He is an expert of Huna wisdom, Huna healing, and I saw his picture, and he's a young-looking guy, and he's a wise young-looking guy with a lot of ancient wisdom. So we're going to talk to him about how he embraced the Huna tradition, and what he brings forward from the ancient wisdom to the modern world. Hello, Dr. Matthew.
Hi there. Thank you for having me on the show.
Thank you for being on. I imagine it's pretty early out there in beautiful Hawaii where you have taken abode.
Well, it's all right. Our kids wake us up a little bit early, so we're usually up around 6. I've been up for a while.
You have kids. I mean, your face looks like you're about 12.
Thank you. I think.
Is this your Huna healing on yourself? If you're young and you're really like 97?
Well, one of my teachers said that when you carry baggage, it puts weight on your physical body. I think I asked him one time, why does his teacher, who's in his 90s, look so young and so happy? And he said, when you don't carry a lot of negative emotions, it doesn't weigh down on the physical body. So I think having practiced this at an early age, I guess it's been pretty helpful.
Well, good. It's a wonderful testimony that you're doing the right thing and you're bringing forward wonderful information and wisdom for others. So we'll get into some of the some of your teachings and some of the work that you do as a healer. I just wanted to quickly suggest, before we even get rolling, to let everybody know that your website is www.huna.com. So put that down in your your little book of important addresses, and you can check Matthew James later when you are not listening to him, so you won't be losing time studying his website rather than tuning into what he has to say. Okie doke. Well, like I said, you look terribly young to be so wise, so my first question for you is, I know that you're a university studied person, but obviously you've had some interesting contact with the ancient wisdom of Huna at a young age. Can you tell us when you first came in contact with the Huna tradition?
With the Huna tradition specifically, my father in the early 80s began to study with a person named David Bray Jr., who was the son of one of the last practicing kahunas that lived here in the islands of Hawaii. And he had no one to pass his information on to, and gave my father permission and entrusted into our family the lineage of the Bray family.
How
exciting. So I began to learn actually from my father right around that time. Prior to that, I had actually become very interested in meditation. I actually begged my mom to teach me how to meditate at the age of 5, which she did. So by the time my father was beginning to teach me the basics of Huna as a 12, 13-year-old, I was beginning to really delve into the importance of this information, and truly, I grew up with this, and I mentioned this to students because when my father decided to not teach it anymore, and it was my turn to step up, the people that were around, we call them kupuna, lo'ea, the guides, the elders, the people that in the culture here in Hawaii have a say of what can and cannot be taught, they really looked at me and said, it's in your family. It was in there for a reason. And they go, you know, you teach people that they have a choice in life. And one of my teachers, Auntie Bernie Kononui, she said to me, you know, you teach people that you have a choice, but she looked at me and she said, you know, you don't have a choice. It's in your family. You need to do something with it. And so truly, I explain this to people as I teach this because it's not something I read in a book or took as a seminar or training. It's something that really I grew up with and has been a part of my family. And actually, it's 28 generations that this information has been taught.
It's so exciting that certain people are, I hate to say chosen because it sounds like it's got ego attached to it, but how certain people outside of the indigenous families are recognized in some way, and as you said, handed down to your father was the wisdom of this lineage. Obviously, they saw in him perhaps prophecy, perhaps just the heart of who this person was, the one who could carry the tradition possibly farther than they could.
Well, the people here in Hawaii in ancient times believed that the most intelligent person was the one that could trust their gut, their na'au, their center. In Western thinking, we always pride the person who is the most intelligent as being the most intelligent, who has the most degrees or who has the most books that they've read. And truly, I believe that in our modern application of these ancient wisdoms, it's a balance of the two. Because some people are trying to go so far back that they want to throw away the things that we have. But the ancients, all of them, across the board, loved technology. And people wouldn't have thrown away.
I think that we are at such a crossroad now, and certainly it's a time of bringing together science and spirit. This is something I'm very, very tuned into and concerned about, that we stop trying to prove the other wrong and ourselves right, and recognize that there is wisdom in all knowledge. But it is nice when you hear scientists say, maybe the spiritualists have got it right all along, which we're starting to hear from the quantum physicists, for example.
Oh, yeah, when quantum physicists found that deep level of raw energy and then condensed light in everything, it was a wonderful day. I mean, truly to be able to express that on stage where I say, you know, in Huna, they always talked about you having energy and being a being of light, and now it's proven. Let's get into some deeper topics now that science has actually proven a lot of the things that Huna and the ancient teachings have been talking about for thousands of years.
Exactly. I had famed physicist Michio Kaku on my show some time ago, and he was talking about how people that used to talk about other dimensions were considered kooks. And I said, yes, that would be me. And he said, not anymore, Patricia. Science is catching up. And we now know that, and off he went with all of the wonderful things that are coming out of science from quantum perspectives and multidimensional reality and string theory. It's just a great time to see all of this, to hear scientists of his level say, science is catching up with the spiritualists. Brings great joy to my aging heart. Oh, yes.
Well, I can tell you that, and that's why I went back to school. I mean, that's why I went back to school and got a PhD. And I got it in psychology because that's the area that the Huna that I teach focuses on. And the Huna that I teach really focuses on how the spirit, mind, and emotions trickle down and affect the physical. And I remember teaching in the 90s, and someone raised their hand and said, where's the evidence? Where's the proof? And that really sparked and got me interested in my late 20s, early 30s to go back to school. And I went back and I got a PhD in psychology so that I can now speak to the Western and the ancient approach of it with some understanding of how these two can be bridged. And so it was the Huna that came first and the schooling that came after.
Well, that's exciting. Let's talk about the deep understanding of Huna. Now, some of the people that are tuning in may never have heard of Huna. Others are well informed. Nonetheless, we want to be able to embrace everyone. So Can you just start with a basic introduction to the predominant principles, the four truths, for example, that underline the Huna philosophy?
Absolutely. Well, first of all, again, Huna is a modern label. It actually, the word Huna means secret, and by the fact that you and I are talking about it in the ancient language, it wouldn't have been called secret anymore. But Huna is a modern label for an ancient system of empowerment of the mind, body, spirit. And it looks at how your energy from the spiritual aspect of who you are and your thoughts and emotions can affect your physical reality. And that can either be looked at then as your physical body with regards to healing or your physical world with regards to how you perceive what is occurring outside and whether you're able to manifest the things that you truly desire. And the four
right, but that is the kind of the principle of most esoteric wisdom. So what sets Huna apart?
What sets Huna apart, I think, is two things. First of all, it's a fairly complete system with an unbroken lineage. I mean, that's just it. I've delved into Vedic teachings, tantric teachings, Western esoteric magic with a K. I've met people of the Native American culture. We've trained the son of a chief over from the First Nation who came over, and he summed it up best. He said, Huna doesn't have anything that is new or different than any of the other. And in fact, every person that I've met that's on a spiritual path say all paths lead to the light. We may call these different, we may use different labels, but we're all saying the same thing. So I don't believe I can say anything new. I don't believe that Huna has something new. What Huna has is the people I studied with, I can trace it right back to practice, and there's been an unbroken lineage where some places you have 400, 700 years where Western thinking attempted to wipe it out, and there was no practice, and they're attempting to reclaim it. Huna's unbroken. There's been no gap from the ancient practice into the modern expression.
I like that. So in essence, what you're saying is it's relatively undiluted.
It's undiluted. It was, and the interesting thing about the lineage that I carry, Daddy Bray, the father of the person that taught my father, believed that you might as well just tell it like it is. You might as well call it as you see it, because all you're doing is expressing your reality. It's not about right or wrong. And that if you have something to share with someone, share it. If they're meant to hear it, they will. And if they won't, they'll just think you were talking about, like what you said, crazy stuff.
You say there's a foundation of four truths, as I mentioned earlier, that we must experience in order to create lasting personal transformation. Can you go into these four truths for us so we can create a sort of groundwork to emerge from in our dialogue today?
Absolutely. The first one, and these, by the way, are called the laws of Huna, or you've heard of the law of attraction. I have to assume you have heard of the law of attraction.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. One of the laws that I teach is the law of attraction. However, you learn that after you learn these four basic, because if not, the law of attraction just becomes affirmations. And an affirmation is you keep saying you're happy, and if you're sad, you can say you're happy as much as you want, but if you haven't released the sadness, it just doesn't work. Now, I've seen the law of attraction work, and it works when you have these four basic that are the foundation. And the first one is simple. It's perception is projection. Well, it's simple in that it's easy to explain and a little bit more difficult to incorporate. And that is that mm-hmm. what you see outside is a reflection of what's inside. And what you see inside is a reflection of what's outside. And my easiest example is, if you've ever woken up on a day where you're in a bad mood, the world looks different than when you wake up on a day in a good mood. The world didn't magically change. It's that you changed inside. And then mm-hmm. you see things differently. The book Flow by Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi sums it up best and really discusses from a scientific standpoint how this occurs. The second basic truth is cause and effect, and that is that every action has a reaction. And that when you put something out there into your path of travel, it's going to come back. And that we have to give up thinking that it's someone else's job to fix us and begin to take responsibility in our own lives, because cause and effect is about becoming responsible for your actions and reactions to your physical reality. The third and fourth are pretty well tied together, and they are the law of creation and cycles and rhythm. And creation basically says that when something exists, it exists as a part of a dichotomy, so that there is a duality that we experience in our universe. Even existence is a part of a duality, and the duality can be the complete opposite, meaning not existing, and day and night, man and woman, light and dark. Then cycles and rhythm says that these dualities that we create, there's a flow of energy that goes back and forth between them. Kind of like the day is hotter and the night is hotter in the summer. That's the day giving off more. And in the winter, there's less day, and the winter is more powerful, if you wanted to use the English word powerful. And it makes everything really cool. These four basic truths, when you understand them, and by the way, in ancient times here in Hawaii, these were just known by everyone, which is what allowed the kahuna to operate as they did, because everyone had this foundation that the world is a reflection of you. You have a great deal of responsibility in your own experience, that you're a part of a duality that you are intimately connected with, not separate from what you think is opposite. And there's an energy flow between you and that which you think is opposite of you.
Yes, if I could interject something here. Of course, since we have become so immersed in video technology, we have lost the contact with the earth so much that people have lost that sense of understanding the balance and the harmony of even the seasons. Because how many hours a day are they inside glued to a holographic reality, rather than tuning into the earth's rhythm and song?
I agree with that, and I would also say that it occurred a lot earlier than technology. I've had discussions with some of my upper-level HUNA students, and we've gone into the who's really to blame here. And one person said computers are to blame and working indoors. And I've heard that one before, and I go, very true. I will tell a new student, get outside. Connect with the elements. During one of my weekend trainings, I looked out at the group and they weren't connecting. And so we got up and we went outside. That's an easy thing to do. However, really, if you look back at it, it came out to the point where we believed we could observe things and not be connected to it. And that occurred long before we had computers and televisions. And it's undoing that belief that we can observe something and yet not be connected to it, the observer effect.
Right. The problem is when you start talking about television and video screens is there is an element of electromagnetic entrainment.
Oh, of course. Yeah, the logos trance, that when you get in front of something like that, that you can be slipping back into that trance that allows you to go to sleep even while you're awake. No, I agree with that 110%. Here's how the ancients in Hawaii viewed the external. They said that in order to do something, you had to be puno. You had to be right with three things. You had to be right with yourself. You had to be right with the aina. And the word aina literally means land. But in this translation or context, John Kaimikawa said that the ancients believed that everything outside them was what they had to be puno with. And that included not just the land, but everyone else that you saw that lived on the land. And then the third thing is you had to be right or puno with higher consciousness, your spirit, or if you believe in religion, God or the goddess. And so these three things had to be right before you would proceed. So even if you're standing in front of a computer screen, that can't become an excuse for you to realize that everything outside you, that when you take action, you need to be right with all of those things outside you, right with yourself, and right with higher consciousness. And we don't tend to do that in current thinking.
Yeah, you know, in fact, it quite amazes me because I'm also a teacher and I deal with a lot of really developing people around the world, and yet this concept that it's happening to me rather than I'm creating it, people know the language but don't necessarily really understand how they create it, and it leads to so much frustration and disempowerment. And at the essence of teachings like HUNA and other indigenous wisdom it's such a simple concept. But
it is, and
sometimes
I think
the most simple things are the most difficult for us to understand.
Oh, I agree, and I say that all the time in my workshops. I say we overly complicate these things.
Yeah.
They are such simple concepts, and you really do have to begin with perception as projection. And here's what I have learned, having taught this now for, geez, I don't know. Well, I've been practicing it for, I think, 25, 26 years, having been teaching it for well over 10. Here's one thing that I've learned. If you don't get that the world is a reflection of you, then to become responsible for your actions, to become that person who's responsible for your reactions, to get to cause, in other words, is much more difficult. Because when you don't understand that that person that you don't like that's standing over there, that person that you've been blaming things on is actually just a reflection of something going on inside you, then you can't truly own the experience. And so in ancient times, I believe the practitioner started with this rather than with cause and effect.
I agree with that. And we do also want to address the question of the more long-distant disharmony. For example, when you talk to people and they say, that's all well and good, Patricia, but I certainly can't believe that something that I'm doing is helping create the poverty in Africa or the Iraq situation or whatever. And this is from a global or even a galactic point of view, I think it's very important for people to start to understand not only how they affect their immediate environment, but how those thoughts ripple out in the cosmic sea and manifest all, the whole picture, the whole reality as we perceive it, from the door, from your home, from the outside your door, all the way over across the waters to other nations and behaviors of other people.
Well, my son and I were just talking the other day, and Africa is one of the continents that I haven't been to. I've never been to Africa and never been to Antarctica. So I have a couple more to do, I admit. And having said that, I had a student that was just here in our workshop in Kona. I run a 9-day HUNA workshop twice a year. And a student who's been coming here for a good couple, three or four years now, actually, her name's Donna. By the way, I got permission to share this story because it's a fabulous story. Someone brought up, well, what about poverty in Africa? Oddly enough, you just mentioned that. And I said, Donna, didn't you just come back from going over to Africa because you're working on she has some project that she's doing over there with some really fantastic leaders in the communities to really help to get some momentum going. And she said, yeah, I just came back from Africa. I said, how's the poverty? She said, what poverty? And the other lady looked at her and said, wait, what do you mean? And Donna goes, well, of course. She goes, if I go down into Detroit right now or into Michigan,
exactly,
you can find places that are thriving and places that look like poverty. She goes, of course there's poverty in Africa. She said, but most of these people that I've met that we hold in our mind as being poor and, these poor people, and, we should go help them. She goes, when I go there, I feel like the poor one because they look at me. How do you not know these things? How are you not empowered? So what if we don't have a brand new pair of Levi's jeans? So what if we don't have a meal where we can't eat it all and we end up throwing it away? We have things you don't have. And Donna said, I do less teaching and more how do we blend what I know into what you know to create empowerment here. And she goes, I no longer see the people as poor. And she goes, as a continent as a whole, if you're including South Africa, there's not as much poverty as you would think. Can things be better? Yes. Things can always be better. But as long as we hold entire continents in our reality as being less than perfect, we hold those people as less than perfect. That's something inside of us that we need to change, not outside.
Always remembering that we have yet to find perfection in our own Western concept of what civilization means. We're certainly not doing a great mastery of conquering poverty in Western nations.
And I think that was Donna's point. Donna's whole point was that if you look for poverty, you can find poverty. If you look for enlightenment, you can find enlightenment. And that's cause and effect. Cause and effect is that all of these realities exist. I'm not denying that they don't exist. And in fact, Daddy Bray, where my lineage flows from, was one of the rare kahunas that said, you know what, there are people on the planet that want to do bad things. And it's up to you as to what you experience. Some kahuna would shy away and say, I'm not even going to talk about that. And he would just say, look, obviously there are people who don't practice the light. You have a choice, though, as to whether that even comes into your reality. And he said, I've met people that believe in these things so much, they end up creating it. It becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. He says, I don't see these things, not because they don't exist,
yeah,
because I want to see what I want to see.
And this is an appropriate conversation that we're heading into. I'm going to ask you about 2012, but before I do that, I just want to, for people who come in late, I'd like to reannounce that I'm speaking to Dr. Matthew James. He's a Huna master teacher. His website is www.huna.com. And if you've just tuned in, please grab a chair and stay tuned, because we're going to go into some pretty interesting fields of manifestation and what it all means for 2012. 2012 comes up, Matthew, because I'm seeing so much, the beginning of so much propaganda to put people into fear.
Of course,
we've got plenty of propaganda for putting people to fear about everything, but suddenly there's this new favorite fear-mongering, which is 2012 and what's going to happen. And so this cause and effect conversation that we're having is so relevant to helping people stay empowered and balanced as we approach this date, which we are creating as some kind of final reality. I'd like to have your take on this from the Huna perspective of how people can, your take in general about 2012 and how you perceive the process that we're going to go through.
Well, I've never had a chance to say this yet in our discussion. The phrase "Aohe pau koike ko halau" means that think not that all wisdom is in your school. It was a saying that one of my teachers had above his school, and it was to realize that I'm people that are listening to me probably know things that I don't know, and I know things that some of the listeners probably don't know. And this is just a sharing of information. It's not about making one path right and another one wrong. In fact, to do that is counterproductive. We spend way too much time arguing over whose path is right and whose is wrong.
Mm-hmm,
if we stopped that alone, we would have harmony. Having said that, I got three big things, and you put such a big smile on my face with 2012, because you're right. People are beginning to talk, and first of all...
And panic,
right. Do you remember Y2K? I do.
Oh, yes. I use that example all the time.
I use that one all the time, too. And, yeah, I know you said my picture.
I always say, you know, the sky is falling. Y2K came and went, the sky didn't fall.
Right.
And in fact, there is a certain amount of, I'm sure you'll agree with this, of disappointment subtly masked in other emotions that when you talk to people that were all geared for the final countdown, there was a letdown in a certain vibration that something catastrophic didn't happen.
Right, I know. We tend to thrive on this negativity, and that's unfortunate. That's a whole other discussion, thriving on negativity. We've learned how to do that in Western thinking very well. But it's so important
not to do it for 2012, because we have a collective of 8 billion people all beginning to contemplate that date. And so we are going to create something for sure.
I was saying, here's the deal. I don't think the world's going to end.
No, I don't either.
And a person said to me, what if you're wrong? And I said, well, then I would rather be wrong on my side than on your side. Because if you think the world's going to end and if it doesn't, you're in a lot bigger heap than I am. That's just very practical. One is very practical. What side would you rather be wrong on? I said, in the afterlife, whatever it is, you can laugh at me if I was wrong. I'll even probably be laughing. But truly, to be wrong on your side is like I actually knew someone that went and racked up their credit card debt because they believed Y2K was going to cancel it out. And he's in jail now for credit card fraud.
Wow! That's heavy.
It's not a gloating thing that I'm saying here. It's truly, you got to look at it and say, you know what, the world could end today. live your life to the fullest every day.
To
realize
the fullest.
That the world's going to continue. It's a fabulous planet. It's going to continue. The second thing is that I do believe it is a big event. From an astrological perspective, from an astronomy perspective, from the Mayan calendar's perspective, it is a big date. But we live in such a linear world. The Mayan calendar was not a line. The Mayan calendar was a circle.
Right.
And the equivalent of people thinking that the Mayan calendar ending means that the world's going to end would be the equivalent of 5,000 years in the future. Someone finds the calendar that I have up above my desk, and they look at it and they go, oh, the calendar ends on December 31st. Matthew thought the world was going to end that day.
Well, the Mayans never claimed the world was going to end. All of the Mayan wisdom points to a fifth sun, a fifth cycle, which we are free to interpret as we will, because all of us who are working for the spirit and the light want to see that as an evolution of humankind and a higher vibration. But they don't, not that I'm aware of, there's nothing that really declares what that was meant to be, other than understanding that in the nature of a fifth, there can't be an end.
Right. Well, the Mayan calendar, again, was a circle, and there were, I believe,
exactly.
Either three or four circles, but the inner circles have already rotated and gone round many times. The smaller one in the center, absolutely. I think that's either the yearly one, and again, I'm not a Mayan expert. I remember I had a student who had studied this very extensively, and he looked up at me when the group brought this up, and he said, the outer circle is making its first spin fully around, but all the other ones have made the spin around, and we've been fine.
Well, I just was honored to have lunch with Jose Arguelles, who I'm sure you've heard of, the Mayan Factor, and his companion Stephanie South, and we had some pretty exciting conversations about the Mayan calendar, and he's pretty excited about us moving into a more galactic Mayan time, the time of the galactic Maya, and
yes.
The time of a higher, more galactic human race. And quite honestly, let's go for it. I'm more than ready for some evolutionary kickstart or jump start that pushes us into a higher awareness. And I'm not suggesting that somebody waves a magic wand and we all get to jump up a higher notch, but that some reality that we all deal with on a collective helps us understand the meaning of life and our purpose, and perhaps that phenomenon, which could be anything, helps us rise as a collective, because we certainly could do with some higher perspective on human reality.
I agree. And what I would add to that is that this has already been occurring as far back as the 80s. I've had some people say no, a lot earlier than that. And most people that haven't studied astrology or astronomy, and it could be either, and I've had some people say, why do you say astrology? Because most people who are well-versed in non-predictive astrology, meaning that they look at it more as energies and how Jung looked at it as more of archetypes and perception as projection, they get this concept more than the average individual who hasn't studied this. And people are looking at that Mayan date and thinking some sort of light switch is going to be flipped. But the universe
right.
doesn't operate like a light switch. I'm in a room right now, and if I walk over and flip a switch, the light is either on or off. But it's also 7:30 or so in the morning over here, and the sun is not up yet. But it began to get light. It began to get a lot lighter before the sun fully came up. And so a lot of people are looking at that date thinking that some switch is going to be flipped and that all of a sudden we're going to switch into the new mode. But truly, like a sunrise or a sunset, there's been a slow build-up to this.
Absolutely.
And to this date for at least a couple of decades, if not longer.
I would like to say it hasn't been that slow either, to be honest. I mean, we've certainly seen, we got a little distracted with the 80s and 90s, and but certainly since the last decade and a half, in the last few years particularly, we seem to really be spinning into something big. And even
absolutely.
People who are not that necessarily aware of these kinds of subtle vibrations are saying that they're losing time, that time is mutating. I think that one of the important things that's happening and that was indicated in that calendar is that the Mayans were saying we're moving out of linear time.
Right.
And that's why the calendar ends, because it's the end of that mode of thinking. And that's why we're all stuck on 2012, December 12, 2012, because we're really linear thinkers, and it's hard to get our minds around what it's going to be like if we're not in that paradigm of that linear reality.
I would agree with that, and that slow buildup that we've seen. I remember teaching 10 years ago and having to spend almost an hour in a weekend training talking about the mind, body, spirit, and how the mind and body are connected, and people would argue with me. No, I don't think emotions really affect the body. People don't argue
about
it. Yeah, so even over this past decade, thank you Deepak Chopra, thank you the movie What the Bleep Do We All Know, thank you The Secret for teaching us, and when students come to my weekend workshops, they're coming in already armed with this knowledge. And I've had people say to me, have you seen a shift in consciousness? And I can say, having been out there working with people who have had no exposure to this material, there has been a massive shift in consciousness. And I do believe it's related to this, because it's a big deal from, what is it, the entire solar system is going to dip now beneath the, if you put the whole thing on a horizon, we're switching our entire perspective. We're moving to a whole different cycle. It's pretty big, and yet I don't think that we're going to wake up the next day and feel very different. It's going to be like a birthday. That day will be a big deal, and then afterwards you're a year older. Now what are you going to do with that? What are you going to do with the change of consciousness? Because the world can change, and you might change along with it, or the world can change, and you might not change along with it. So I don't think it's going to also affect everyone. It's going to affect the people that want to be affected by it.
And in our pursuit of wisdom and conspiracy information, I certainly enjoy exploring some of those things and do in my books. Sometimes we lose sight of the very essential quality of life, which is almost considered trite by some people. But to me, it's just the ability to create beauty and happiness, to feel happiness. And some people say, well, how can you be happy, in Patricia? I mean, you can't be conscious and be happy. And I say, au contraire.
Actually, what
I would
say
better
is that
expression of consciousness than to be at peace and joyful with everything that's around and within you?
Well, I think built into a lot of the teachings in Western thinking is this idea that suffering is somehow linked to being spiritual, being religious, being
enlightened. Why is that? Suffering and poverty.
Suffering and poverty is somehow a spiritual, and I teach a weekend called the Huna Prosperity Weekend. And about 10 years ago, I went on a radio show and said, you can actually be successful and enlightened. And I got emails from people saying, how dare you say that? But everyone I know that has been enlightened has been extremely successful right along with it. And I'm not measuring success by a bank account. See, people usually have in their mind, I'm talking about cash. No, I'm talking about being able to manifest happiness, joy, success, abundance, wealth, prosperity, not just money, but in friends and in love. And truly, I don't think you can be spiritual and suffering. I think that when you are suffering, that's feedback from the universe. You're heading in the wrong direction.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you're going to a teacher who is avowed to a life of poverty and suffering, I'm not motivated by such a teacher. It's like when people ask me about this question, I say, you know, be a model for what you want the world to be. If you want to know what my suggestion is to you, because they ask, you know, I don't know what my mission is, I don't know what category, what area I want to go into. I could just work on being a model of beauty and joy and what you want the world to be. If you can go out there and just be that for people, and people can feel that light radiating out of you, you are doing great work.
Exactly. And I can tell you why I think that people teach that poverty is a good thing in a spiritual path, and it's just kind of a, I have an idea as to why this might be, and the reason why I think it is that attachment is not a good thing. When you get attached to the physical, it earths your energy.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you are attached, it does prevent you from rising up to spirit. However, rather than dealing with it, people just say, lead a life of poverty, then that way there's no attachment.
Well, that works for the ascetics who go sit in a cave in the mountains of India and Kathmandu and Nepal and just resonate on that level. But we do live in a very, not technical, not commercial, crowded modern world where we...
we live on a physical planet.
We're physical beings, and there are great joys in being able to create beauty around us. And if you find that beauty in sitting in a forest and living with nature, great. And if you find that in creating a beautiful home for yourself, there's nothing negative attached to that. If anything, it's inspirational that you manifest what you want to create for yourself and for the people that you love. The problem is the addiction to it.
That's it. That's the word right there. It's that
I meet a lot of people, especially now, that are just addicted to all this stuff, and then you've lost the simple beauty of it. If you can have it and enjoy it without being addicted to it, then by all means, that to me is a very spiritual reality and framework to work with it.
And that's it right there. I had a friend who on their Facebook page posted that they had lost their iPhone, it fell down, it cracked, and they were holding a vigil for it, and that they were mourning it. And I thought it was all a joke, and I actually posted, oh, ha-ha, you're being funny. And they wrote me back and said, no, this is a massive loss. You don't know how important this is to me.
They weren't kidding?
No, they weren't kidding.
Come on.
Now, this is a friend. It's not one of my students. Because the simple person said, why didn't you teach them? And I went, wait a minute. I have friends that they look at me and they go, you're my friend, Matt. You're not my teacher. I know what you do, and I just want to be your friend. And I have a mother, by the way, and a father. And to them, I'm the son. I don't go and teach them, although they will sometimes ask me for advice. However, I just bringing up the iPhone because 2 days ago, our three-year-old was about to fall off of a chair, and my wife reached out to grab her, knocked over a cup of coffee right onto her iPhone. And her reaction was pretty simple. Huh, I wonder if it's going to work. And when it didn't, it was no big deal. She just looked at me and said, what do we do? And I went, well, you know, I'll take it into Apple and see if they'll replace it. And we ended up having to pay some money for it. But to me, the money that we paid to replace the iPhone was much of little importance in comparison to catching our three-year-old daughter. And a lot of people put so much importance in the physical. And it's not that it's not important, and it's not that it is important. It's that it is just the physical reality.
Exactly. I would like to also suggest, as I'm sure you have already thought, that maybe that iPhone got knocked out for a reason.
Exactly. And we don't
baby crying, iPhone gets knocked out. Maybe it's like, guess what, baby more important than phone.
Right. And then when someone in the Apple store said, oh, I'm really sorry, I went, no, the kid's more important than the phone.
But it's really shocking to me. I also am a teacher. I travel around the world putting on workshops and seminars, and I'm just back from Macedonia, which is a relatively poor country. But, man, these people have all got the top technology cell phones.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm like, guys, I do not want these cell phones on in this room. Let's make this a game. Come on, you can do it. And they were just not on my body. I talked to them about the entrainment and the pollution and all this stuff. I go, just forget all of that. I just want you to feel how good it feels to know that you can do without it. Because if you can't, you're addicted. Do you really want to be addicted to this little gadget. What does this tell you about yourself? And they couldn't.
Right, and that's attachment. That is
big time attachment addiction. And they and some of them tried to sneak, because I asked them to put them out on a table in the back of the room, and they weren't about to do that because somebody could steal it. But more than that, people really want this gadget on their body. And to me, this is entrainment. I think it's very dangerous.
I
sound like an old granny, and it's like only dangerous if you make it dangerous. But still, I'm a proponent of eliminating the cell phones from your physical space, from your auric field. Get them out, please. And I guess I go against the grain of modern reality on this one.
Yep, I would agree with you wholeheartedly, and I would actually apply this to a lot of things in the physical, and that is that Papa Bray, when he was teaching my father, said very simply, the physical world, your physical body, it all flows from spirit, meaning that there's a trickle down from the spiritual to the mental to the emotional to the physical. And to call any part of it evil, dirty, or nasty is to call spirit evil, dirty, or nasty. If everything flows from spirit, then it is a reflection of that higher consciousness realm. And what you need to learn is not how to disattach, not how to let go of, not how to get greedy of, but to truly just learn how to enjoy all aspects of the physical in a calm, centered, and balanced way, period. That's it.
Right, but people are not in a calm, centered, and balanced mindset with these cell phones. Because they can't detach enough to be in the moment of what they're doing. It's always, a lot of them are working with the phones while they're talking to you, digitizing or whatever they do. I don't know. I don't use a cell phone hardly ever, so I don't get it. But it is important to recognize, not hate or not claim evil, but recognize how these gadgets can be destructive in distracting you from being in the moment. And the best way, in my opinion, to do that is just check. Can you be without it for a day, for a week? Try it. And most people can't do it. But I think it's a really good lesson for any kind of addiction or attachment to see if you can do without it for a day, for a week. And if you can, then you're not addicted.
Well, I do that. I make a commitment, and I did this a long time ago with my kids, that there's a no computer, no cell phone day, and we go do something.
Yeah, that's great.
It's easy to do. At first, no, it can be a little bit difficult. And by the way, I want to point something out. As a parent, if we are traveling somewhere, I had someone say to me, well, you don't leave your cell phone at home. No, I turn it off. Of course I bring it, because I live 30 miles away from the closest city. Of course, if my car broke down on the road on the way, I would be very happy to have a cell phone handy on me. But I turn the ringer off, and I say to my son and I say to my daughter, okay, let's go. No phone calls today, no computer. Let's just go do something. That really helps to ground you, I think. Oddly enough.
Yeah, how many children don't have parents that say that? It's important, Matthew. It's really important. It's even the same with any other kind of addiction. I mean, Franco and I are, my partner and I, we live in Italy, and wine, I've been drinking wine since as a child. We used to drink a half a glass of wine with our dinner since I was a child, because Italians don't abuse wine. Wine is considered something like food. In fact, they drink wine with the meal, and then it doesn't go, they don't drink any more wine.
Right.
And once I said to him, you know, we're drinking wine every night with dinner. Do you suppose we have a problem? And he said, what kind of problem? And he laughed, because sometimes Italians are far less mental than we are. And I said, I'd like to just have dinner without the wine. He said, okay, whatever. And so we did that for a few weeks. I said, okay, we definitely don't have a problem with the wine. But it is really good to just check once in a while, make sure that you're not slipping into some kind of an addiction, or as you call it, attachment, to something that might or might not be for your highest interest. And I really feel very strongly about the technology, particularly the cell phones and what's coming. So I would think that it would be a good idea to suggest this to people to check their kids like you do. I think that's really fabulous that you find that day and let them understand that they can live without these distractions.
Yeah, and I really do think it comes down to what you said with the wine, because my wife and I would agree with you wholeheartedly. We just came back from Italy, actually. And what we find is that not just with wine, not just with cell phones, when you make something taboo, then the younger generation tends to gravitate towards it even more when they get into that rebellion phase. And
that's
wine
right.
was never a big deal growing up in our house. When I got to a certain age, I would have a little tiny glass with dinner, and then that was it. And so it never
became... In fact, when I was a teenager, my friends used to want to go out and get drunk, and I'd go, you got to be kidding, right? If I'm going to drink wine, I'm going to drink good wine from my house. And so my mother said, I'm going to make you a deal. I want you to tell your friends that if they want to drink, they can come here. She was a very smart woman. And she said, I won't rat on them, but I will make sure that they're not too drunk to drive. And
right.
she used to make, my friends would come over, and she'd serve wine and spaghetti. And the thrill was gone of sitting in a car somewhere and drinking garbage wine and getting drunk and throwing up, which is what 16-year-olds were doing.
Right.
And it was just a beautiful experience for me, because there was no intrigue in it, because there was no addiction, there was no interest in something that was respected. Wine in this culture is... it's food. And when, you know, I love it when I see Americans, not that I'm in any way pinpointing Americans, because I'm one, but American friends will come out and we'll start pouring the wine, and the Americans keep drinking. The Italians stop when the food is gone.
That's
because
very
we,
true.
That it's just their approach to it. I mean, this is just a small example, but I think it was valid to what we were saying. All right, but we're getting off the tracks. I'd like to talk a little bit more about your... Sorry?
No, I said, no, that's all right. I think it's totally applicable to what we're talking about, and that is that Uncle George, George Naope, who's founder of the Merry Monarch Hula Festival, one of my kumus, my teachers, he got up in front of the group in our workshop that we just concluded last week. You know, he's getting close to his 90s now. I think he's actually in his 90s. He never tells his age, but I'm just trying to do the quick math here. Brilliant individual, a true inspiring light. And his message to the group this year was, why do you talk bad about other people and other things? You got to love the person to the right, love the person to the left. Worry about the person in the middle. And realize that in the ancient Hawaiian language, there were no vulgarities. There were no negative things to say, that you learned how to say things in a positive way because there was no way to express negativity, and that you enjoyed everything in life and didn't see it as evil, dirty, or nasty. And he said to embrace that is to embrace the true spirit of the teachings of Huna and of Aloha.
How eloquent. How important it is for us to get back to believing that we are in our highest manifest, in our highest energies, when we allow ourselves to enjoy life, to feel happiness, to just be in that simplicity, and instead of complicating ourselves with pursuits of sometimes mighty and lofty concepts and wisdom and, like you said, magic with the K and all of these other pursuits, when it, as I said earlier in our conversation, it's so simple. Sometimes it eludes us. Hello? Matt? Now, are you eluding me? Don't tell me the line has dropped. Okay, well, it seems like that concept and the line dropped with Dr. Matt. Hopefully we'll get him done, if you can get him back on. And I will continue to talk about what we've been talking about. Matthew has a workshop and a program there in Hawaii. He teaches workshops, and boy, it sounds like a great way to spend some time. So if we're going to get him back on, if not, if we can't get him back on the line, as we are talking to from Hawaii, to Italy,
Hello.
To California, then I would like to invite you all to, again, explore what he has to teach, what he brings forward of the ancient Huna tradition. His site, www.huna.com. Learn more about this wonderful, really just a way of perceiving being in real, in the physical world, you know, obviously
think,
in a beautiful... Matthew, I was just saying that inviting people to go to your site and investigate what it means to be physical in such a beautiful world is surely as beautiful as the place that you've chosen to light in Hawaii. But I did want to get back to talk more specifically about what you offer. What are the workshops about? What kind of programs do you have? And basically, what would bring people to study with you in Hawaii?
I run small weekend workshops all around North America, and I get out to Europe occasionally and out to Asia, Japan. And we run our longer workshops here in Kona every March and September. And truly, actually, the common thread that I have found in the students that have been coming to our workshops is almost exactly what we're talking about here, and that is finding who they are. I originally thought it was going to be people that want to make more money or have a successful relationship or, you know, lose weight, get rid of excess pounds. And what a lot of people said in interviews that were done with my students is that they felt like there was something missing in their life, a big hole, and that they didn't know how to fill it. They kept trying to fill it with, you know, things they would buy or friends that they would have or activities that they would do, and nothing seemed to satisfy them. And that truly when you delve into a path like Huna, they said it fulfilled them and filled that gap. And that's, I think, the common thread that we have there in Huna.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly the perception of if I could only have that, I would be happy. I've certainly known plenty of people in that material search of if I had that new car, I would be cool, and if I had that new whatever, God, I really want that, it's so cool, I would be happy if I had that guy, and this pursuit. And once you get that material objective, you're on to the next one, because you can never find happiness in the pursuit of material things or objects of your desire. That inner happiness comes from being able to just be at peace with who you are, and hopefully a feeling of connectedness with the light, with spirit.
Exactly.
It's so simple, it eludes us. That's what I was saying when the line dropped.
we were talking about technology so much, I think my phone got
yeah, technology is what I say. Okay, you guys, I'll show you what it's like without me.
Okay, so I like technology now. How's that?
I love technology. I do. I'll put up with the little phone, but obviously with all of the technology bashing that I personally can be heard to do, I'm grateful for what it has brought to us as far as unifying us and helping us reach out to each other. I mean, here you are. You're in Hawaii. Dawn, my wonderful producer, is in California. I'm here in Rome, and we've got listeners all over the world, and we're all connected. And it's great to think that we're all connected on higher levels, but it's really nice having the physical manifestation of being able to talk and listen to each other around the world in simultaneous time.
Exactly.
So I am grateful. Yes, I am. All I'm suggesting is that if you're entrained to it, to where you're drugged by it, then it's time to pull back from it and say, do I really need this? And if I, like I said earlier, if you can't be without it, but we get tested. I mean, I'm sure you're traveling all the time, so am I. There are times when I am completely out of range of everything, telephone, TV, the whole works. And it's just a wonderful feeling of being in unconnected zone. Wouldn't you agree?
I love
that. I mean,
that.
Unconnected technologically.
Oh, no, I know. I get exactly what you're saying. My wife and I, when we would take our vacations when we first got together, we would go on cruises, because back then it was what we called a forced vacation. No reception, no internet, no wireless. Now all the ships have it, and so now we find other places to go to. But it's truly, once we did that, we learned the discipline of how to turn it off ourselves rather than being forced into that vacation mode. But I'm a big believer in that.
I am a big believer in it, too, and if nothing else, because it helps us get into that quiet place of just being in the moment and connecting with everything that's around us. Okay, I have just gotten a signal, believe it or not, we are out of time.
Wow.
Wow, did that go fast. All right, everybody, I'm going to have to sign out with Dr. Matthew James. Matthew, thank you for being on. It was great talking to you.
Thank you so much for having me on the show. I appreciate it.
Thank you. His site again, www.huna.com. Check him out. And Matthew, I hope our paths will cross somewhere on this planet, and we can sit down and have a Huna moment or more together.
That would be great. Thank you.
Thank you so much. All right, everybody, gotta go. That went fast. Tune in next Saturday, 10 a.m., Beyond the Matrix, the program that asks you to think outside the box of convention and soar with the eagles. A whole great spirit. Ciao, ciao.